Well, way back in November of 1940, a sudden brutal storm, winter storm, raced from Kansas through Wisconsin, leaving dozens of people dead in its wake. And the unexpected snowstorms, better known as the Armistice Day Blizzard. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. As we are just now getting into the waterfowl hunting season, we kind of remember the lives of the duck hunters who were caught in that storm. And our guest today will give us more insight into what happened when the storm hit. And he'll share some interesting stories tied to the blizzard. Tim Isley back with us, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Happy to answer your questions about the storm, or if you have a storm-related experience to share, we'd love to hear about it as well. Easy to get to us. Give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Tim Isley, thanks for stopping by again.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to be here and talk about this interesting day in state history.
You've written about it. I know Gordon McQuarrie and many, well, a number of people have written about it. You did a fine job. I know Gordon McQuarrie, who you and I both kind of revere.
<You're> right.
Wrote about it. And he had, it might be kind of fun just, if you got a piece you can just read of.
You bet. Thanks, Larry. I think this is one of the, there's many, many things that have been written about it, but one of the best ones was by Gordon McQuarrie, the very first outdoor writer hired by the Milwaukee Journal back in the 1930s. And he wrote this after the storm took place in the Milwaukee Journal. He says, "The winds of hell were loose on the Mississippi Armistice Day and night. They came across the prairies from the south and west, a mighty, freezing, invisible force. They charged down from the river bluffs to the placid stream below and reached with deathly fingers for the life that beat beneath the canvas jackets of thousands of duck hunters. They will tell you of this for years to come. They will recall how Dad and brother were saved, and men who came through it alive together will look at each other with new understanding, as is the way with those who have seen death brush them close. And eventually, they will look back upon it as the year of the big wind. To such a futile phrase will come what now seems to be the greatest hunting season disaster in Northwest history, and perhaps the greatest in the country's history." And that's, yeah, that's what took place. And again, it was this Armistice Day storm was an extreme weather event. And basically, it came in. It was a low front that came in from the northwest, came through the Tacoma Narrows. And in fact, there's a famous video, if you were to look up on the web, of Galloping Gertie. It was a suspension bridge that went up and down and up and down and eventually broke down. But the storm, the low front came down, went down into the south central United States, gained moisture down there, then came up to the Midwest states, and it got a cold front from the north and came in through through Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And that was basically the storm that became the Armistice Day storm.
How'd you, and you've developed quite an interest in this. How'd you get interested in this story?
Well, thanks for asking. Basically, I come from a family of duck hunters. My dad and each of my four brothers, we were avid duck hunters. And so when we'd be out in the marsh, we heard something about the Armistice Day story. And so Dad would talk about it a little bit. Dad was not out during that day hunting. He was an avid duck hunter, but he was not out hunting. He was a student at the university, and he came from his house where my grandparents lived on Sherman Avenue on the east side of Madison, got on the bus with a short sleeve shirt, came into campus that day, and at the end of the day, he was taking the bus back to the east side of Madison, and he said he wished he'd have had a long sleeve shirt on and a jacket because it was cold and freezing. And so that's what happened, that the weather, the wind came in, and it started to rain, and then sleet and snow, and it was a bitter, bitter wind, just a bitter wind.
And, you know, the weather forecast at the time, Adam, you know, weather forecasting then isn't like it is now.
Well, you're exactly right. That's one of the things. In fact, this storm changed the way the National Weather Service predicted weather, because number one, there was only the central office was down in Chicago, and it was not staffed in the evening, and they also didn't have regional forecasts. So after that storm, they went on evenings as well as daytime, and then they went to a regional forecasts so that you had much more local weather. And you remember, I mean, we didn't have cell phones back then.
No.
And people didn't know about it. That's the whole thing. Back during that, or this was 1 year before Pearl Harbor. It was 6 days after Franklin Delano Roosevelt had been reelected. And they were having ceremonies back then. It was on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, celebrating the end of World War I, the greatest war. So that was Armistice Day. And then in 38, it became a legal holiday. And in 54, is when President Eisenhower changed it to Veterans Day. So now we know it as Veterans Day, November the 11th. But this storm came up so quickly. And basically, it was responsible for 154 deaths in the nation, according to the National Weather Service. There have been a lot of different numbers, so I go by the National Weather Service, including 49 people, about half of whom were duck hunters in Minnesota, 13 died in Wisconsin, and 13 in Illinois, and 4 in Michigan. And a lot of people were stranded in the cars. Some froze. Farmers lost thousands of turkeys and chickens, and livestock just froze.
And Spot, I think in your story, a story that you wrote, I think I remember you writing that turkey farmers were selling their turkey frozen whole with the feathers on it for 25 cents.
You're right, because a lot of them died, and it really affected the Thanksgiving tables later on in November of that year. So, and one of the things, too, to remember is that this time of the year is when things like this do occur. It was 1975, November the 10th, when the Edmund Fitzgerald sank in Lake Superior because of a similar storm. 1913, November 7th and 8th, there were a couple of tremendous storms right those days that sent down three ships in Lake Superior. And there was another storm, 11-11-11. Then it was actually a tornado that came through and affected Janesville and dropped a lot of snow. So this happens during that time of the year. So we have to be careful of that.
Barbara in Caledonia, Minnesota, will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. It's worth noting in southeastern Minnesota along the Mississippi River, there was a pilot from Winona, Minnesota by the name of Max Conrad, who really helped in the recovery effort along the Mississippi from Winona and south of La Crosse, Brownsville, to help recover some of the unfortunate fatalities along the river, the men in their blinds.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. Well, anyways, he was Max Conrad, and I had a chance to interview a gentleman by the name of Bill Cool, who was a historian in Winona, and he started a website for Max Conrad. And so he was telling me about him. So he told me that, if I just mention a few things, that day, basically, there were a lot of people who died around Winona. But Conrad took off on a Piper Cub the day after, because that day with the storm, it
you
was
couldn't
too,
get you, a
you
plane up.
Yeah, you couldn't fly. You couldn't see anything with this tremendous wind. So he took a Piper Cub out, which he could get out of his hangar. He had five people holding it down with the winds that were so strong to take off. He flew over the backwaters of the Mississippi River looking for hunters who were stranded. And he returned to the airport to refuel, and he flew the rest of the day and part of the next throwing out supplies and guiding and rescuing boats and stranded hunters who were out there. One of Conrad's daughters, Jana Conrad Costco, lives in Arizona, and I had a chance to interview her. And she was only 5 years old at that time. But she remembers coming in, having Conrad come in intermittently during the day. She said he would go back out to the airport, and he dropped a lot of blankets, maps, food, and things like that to try and lead hunters out. He tried to go over hunters and show them the direction in which to go. And basically, he flew the backwaters and really helped an awful lot of...
Saved a lot of lives.
Yeah, he did. And there were some other people, Joe Geisinger, Al Squires, Cal Vogel, and Bob Bean, who were assistants to Conrad and flight instructors, and they also helped. But Max Conrad saved a lot of lives. And the airport up in Winona is now renamed the Max Conrad Airport. This guy's a fantastic person.
Yeah. Barbara, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Certainly something we did want to bring up about Max. You can join in, too. Maybe you've got an experience or to share or a question about The storm, I hope you'll join in. The number's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. You know, I think it might be useful to kind of go back to that day, and maybe you can kind of walk us through that day for duck hunters. You know, kind of, you know, what was on people's minds and where they went and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, the day dawned very, very warm. So it was a warm, mild day. And the duck season had been very, very slow. So here, and this was, because Armistice Day, this was a holiday. So a lot of people had the day off. And so then they were trying to get out. And they thought, I'm going to get out and go duck hunting. Mm-hmm. One of the people that we'll talk about here is Bill Shear of Madison. Bill is one who I interviewed. And he said he saw the entire flight of northern ducks go down the Mississippi that day. But he said it was one of the worst nights he's ever spent in his life. And that included a few long nights on the front lines in Germany. He started the day in short-sleeve weather, preparing to hunt the Mississippi backwaters around Ferryville. It was about 50 degrees in the morning, he said, with a slight drizzle. And so they were late getting out there. But he said later on, as they were on a grassy island, the sky was practically solid with ducks from bluff to bluff. I didn't think there were that many ducks in the world, he told me. The ducks knew what was coming.
And we'll continue with that story with our guest, Tim Isley, and we've got Gary in La Crosse online. We'll get to Gary, too, as well, has a comment about the storm. But we're going to take a quick look at the news, and we'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Hope you join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Tim Isley, our guest, full-time freelance outdoor writer. Great to have him with us for the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're hearing about the Armistice Day blizzard of 1940 with our guest, Tim Isley. Great to have him back. He's had a longstanding interest in that particular blizzard and some of the stories connected with it. I'm grateful to have him with us to talk about it. Have you had relatives who were involved in that, or maybe you've been caught in a storm while you were hunting? Tell us your story. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We know we've had Gary from La Crosse. Gary, I hope you can hang on for a bit yet, because Tim was right in the midst of talking about what the day was like. And then I really want to bring in Gary as well. But Tim, go ahead.
Thanks, Larry. Well, this was the late Bill Shear, who I interviewed many years ago, and he told me his experience, because it had been 50 degrees in the morning, and then later on it started to rain and sleet. And he said the sky was practically solid with ducks from bluff to bluff. I didn't think there were that many ducks in the world. They knew what was coming. Shear and two other hunting partners, Ole Severson and John Bailey, ran out of shells. There were so many ducks, causing Severson to return to shore for more shells. They were hunting out from Ferryville out in the Mississippi River. Shear joked when he told me that. He said that was Bailey's decision to stay out with him. It was probably the worst decision Bailey had ever made, because Shear recalled that the wind increased and temperatures plummeted with a notable change around 3 p.m. The wind was so strong that Severson could not return to get back to Shear and Bailey. He told me we still had a small skiff out on the island, so we turned it over against a stump to get some protection from the wind. We crawled under the boat to spend the night. It was the only thing we could do. The wind was ferocious. We knew we were in trouble with temperature dropping so quickly. Severson, who was inshore, contacted authorities in Winona to try and get people out to help. He even offered a reward of $1,000 to anybody in town to go out, but nobody could go out during that storm. Shear told me, I was wearing a wool shirt, hunting coat, and hip boots, but nothing heavy because the morning was so warm. During a peak in the storm, two men from Janesville passed by us in a canoe trying to make it to shore. But halfway in, they were swamped, and neither man survived. And I believe one of the men was Mr. McFarland from the McFarland Pheasant Farm down in Janesville. He and his associate were hunting together that day and were two of the people who perished. Scheer told me then, he said, the river froze in patches that night. He was stranded out there, couldn't get back. We knew that if we went to sleep, we would die. So we had to stay awake and keep talking in order to hang on. It's hard to describe, but you shiver so hard that you actually have to stop and rest. People may think I'm crazy, he said, but it was so cold that the field mice that lived on the island crawled up on us looking for warmth. Scheer and Bailey made it through the night, and by morning the wind had stopped. Telephone lines were down due to the wind and ice, so Madison radio stations broadcast that hunters died on the river, and Scheer's parents had no idea whether he was living or dead. But using the small skiff, Scheer and Bailey were able to make it to shore about 7 a.m., where they were met by a crowd of onlookers. Our feet were frozen like stumps, he said, and after an initial examination by a doctor, we were rushed to St. Francis Hospital in La Crosse, which probably helped to save John's feet. The doctors there put grease on our feet and immobilized Bailey's feet in glass-like boots, which helped the circulation. I couldn't feel anything in my feet for 6 weeks. School kids came in and visited us in the hospital, and we stayed there a week and were released. I can't say enough for the people at the hospital. They gave us wonderful treatment. And after the experience, Scheer always warned other hunters to take plenty of warm clothes and be prepared for the bad weather. He said it was a freak storm, and we were caught on a treacherous piece of water. I was a young lad of 17 then and figured I had plenty of years of hunting ahead of me, so I couldn't give up that night.
Gary in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Gary, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. I had a building in Genoa, Wisconsin, for a couple of years that I rented as a restaurant. And I had a gentleman walk in one day in his early 80s, and he started to tell me stories about this storm. And he had said that they put bodies on the second floor of that building until they were identified. He said they were basically frozen, so they carried them upstairs and laid them out. And as the restaurant became a restaurant, one of the owners had passed away. And the standing joke in Genoa was that the building was haunted. But this gentleman was sure that it wasn't the owner that passed away, that it was the duck hunters that laid to rest in the second floor.
Oh, man, what a story.
Interesting. I'm sure that happened, yeah. In the Mississippi, the duck hunters out on the Mississippi were caught out there. And, of course, you realize, too, that, you know, the Mississippi River was not the Mississippi years beforehand. That used to be just a small stream and river. And basically it was in the 1930s when the locks and dams were put in. So here it is, 1940. So a lot of that is new water. You know, they flooded it then. And so people were out, but also because there was all the habitat there, the ducks used the river to stream down the river. So that's why there were a lot of hunters out on the Mississippi.
Gary, thank you so much for calling and for that, sharing that memory with us. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. You can email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And somebody else was wondering, well, Kitty says, Kitty in Hudson called but couldn't stay with us. She says her mom was in a high school biology teacher in Viroqua during the time of the storm. And she grew up hearing many stories of the storm. And, well, she didn't give us one of her stories, but she... That stuck with people for their whole lives.
Right. People remember it. The people who were around back then, and obviously the people who were out, but people who were around had relatives who were out. It was a big story, and people talked about it for a long time. I can give you another one, Jim Bussani, who was a duck hunter, and he's passed away now. And that's the thing. See, a lot of these people have passed away, just like World War II vets. They're getting older, and they pass away. But he had told me about going out with his dad, basically out of Goose Island, south of La Crosse. And he said, we had a duck boat tied up from the shore that my dad decided not to use, which probably saved our lives. Instead, Bosani's father took their fishing boat, an aluminum boat with a 5-horse motor. They started out from the landing around 3 a.m., making their way out. So they were out early in the morning in a warm weather to hunt opposite Brownsville, Minnesota. Of course, they didn't, he said, we didn't have Gore-Tex back then, but they did have some wool shirts, canvas jackets, and black hip boots, he said. They never had waders back then. But his dad instructed him to when going out, to pull the hip boots down, so just in case any water came in, it wouldn't come into his boots. He said it was warm. We were out in our shirt sleeves and then took our coats off after setting up on an island. But all of a sudden, in mid-warning, the wind shifted and all hell broke loose. My dad said, pick up the decoys. Let's get out of here. Because the strong winds, he said, were so strong, it was a job even to get out and get the decoys, and he wasn't sure that they actually got them all in. He said the ducks were going backwards, pushed back by the wind, trying to fly into and with the wind. They were low and all over the place. It then started to rain, followed by sleet and then snow. I'd lost my gloves, he told me, but Dad got the boat and told me to get on the oars and row while he tried to start the motor. The motor started, and as the waves were coming over the side of the boat, the water started to freeze. Dad said to just pull on the oars, which was good because it kept me warm. But the water was freezing on my hands. There was no way Dad could control the direction, but we just went with the wind. I can remember going by one island, and the guys were standing with their duck boat tipped over as a windbreak, and they were yelling, but we couldn't hear them, and there was nothing we could do with the strong wind. The wind was parallel with the ground, and I could hardly see my dad in the back of the boat. The rain came down in sheets, and then it started to snow. By the time they reached shore on the east side of the Mississippi, south of La Crosse and north of Stoddard, it was getting dark. They were a long way from their car, and there was ice in the bottom of the boat. We tied the boat just below the Burlington tracks, and Dad had me stay with it, and he went up and walked to the 1938 Pontiac to get us back home. And they warmed up with a warm bath at home and were just lucky to be alive. The late Jim Bosani Sr.
Richard in Lake Tomahawk has a story for us. Let's go there. Richard, hi.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I sound like what I'm going to tell you is kind of redundant, but it was a story from the event. I never heard it directly from my dad because he had passed on as a result of World War II, but Mom told it to me, and it was a very much of a legend in the entire family. And pretty much the same business. He closed his store that day, planned to do that, left early in the morning. It was 70 degrees when he left from Milwaukee. He called what a lot of hunters call it a butterfly day. And sure enough, he got up to set up and had his decoys out. He was on the island. He went with his friend who was the store manager. And same thing happened. He had to get out that day because I guess it hadn't been a real good hunting
ducks
that season. I don't know. I think it was partially he blamed it on the weather or whatever, but I think he didn't get out as much as he wanted to. Nevertheless, they were out there and not dressed for the occasion. And my goodness, all the same things happened. It happened so immediate. I guess when I was a kid, my mother would tell me I just couldn't believe that the temperature would drop so many, degrees so quickly that the ice started to form on the lake, and to me that was incomprehensible how it could happen. And of course they tried to gather up. I think he lost a lot of his decoys, and the fellow who was with him panicked and broke one of the oars.
Oh.
And so they took up one of the floorboards, in the duck boat, and used that. And after a lot of, I guess, the winds were like coming right at you. It was like a shear wind, we would call it today, direct wind, and the snow. And I guess from the time it went from sleet to snow was very quick. Did get home, eventually found out that they had rescued a dog as a result and so on. So it was, which became a family pet later on, English Pointer. But that was the day it will always live in our family's history as the Armistice Day storm. But the fact that they could have died without the floorboard or the floorboards in the duck boat was another thing. But the fellow panicked and broke the R.
Oh, man. Richard, thanks a lot for calling. Very typical kind of story.
You're exactly right. And his story about not being a good duck season is exactly on the mark, because I've got a copy. I've been a member of Ducks Unlimited for many years, and I've got a copy of their earlier publication before they ever had a magazine. They had a newspaper, and their copy of January 1941. It talks about the 1940 duck season, but there's a paragraph in there that really caught my interest. It said, as the fall migration period approached, weather in Canada continued exceptionally mild up to November the 5th. This condition delayed the main southward flight. Then cold weather swept down, culminating in the terrific blizzard of November 10th and 11th, which took such a disastrous toll of over 30 Minnesota and Wisconsin duck hunters. Most of the ducks rode through the north central states with that storm, according to DU observers and reports. And if you remember, that's what Bill Scherer told me. He thought he had seen the whole migration of ducks from Canada. And basically, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a good story.
Steve in La Crosse will give you a chance. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. So a quick story. Actually, it's a long story. The 1975 storm that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald. We were hunting across from Cold Springs on Pool 9, which is south of Ferryville. Got out in the evening and killed a couple ducks. The motor was kind of iffy. One guy dropped two of us off on stumps. The guy with the boat stayed on the island. Got dark, couldn't start the motor. Finally got it started, picked us up. And we were heading in, and at some point, I thought to myself, we should stay on the island. But we didn't, so we kept going down to just above Linksville, and then the boat landings at Colson, you had to go back north to get to the boat landing half a mile. Anyways, we made it. But the point of the story is the next morning, we went out in front of Copper Creek. And I have never seen this before. I haven't seen it since. There was like 8 or 10 muskrat houses there that were all gone.
Wow. Oh.
You know, so to have a storm that wipes out muskrat houses, they do a pretty good job of construction.
Yeah. That is an amazing story. And it's kind of like that. I'm sure there were a lot of muskrat houses that were lost. And a lot of wildlife, you just wonder, how many all types of wildlife being lost.
Right, right. Obviously, they died. And, in fact, somebody that I had talked to, I knew Art Emke, the late Art Emke. He used to be the district director of the Department of Natural Resources up in Eau Claire. And Art back then, during 1940, he was in fisheries management for the Wisconsin Conservation Department back then. And so he was located down here in Madison. But he told me that the employees received a directive from the secretary of the Conservation Department to go out and rescue some of the wildlife. So Art had an order to go up to Fish Lake in northwestern Dane County that day after the storm and chop out some of the ducks that had actually frozen into the ice up there. And what he told me, he says, when we got there, it was a spectacular sight as we saw all the sorts of ducks that were just bumps in the ice. Each bump had a small air hole on top through which the bird was breathing. The difficult part for Art and the other employees was crawling out on the thin ice. We had to be careful, but we chopped out the ducks and then took them to the game farm in Poinette to thaw out. So there were hundreds of ducks thawing out in the cooler room in the game farm and that then were later released.
Oh, that's a great story. And Steve, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Beverly in River Falls that may have a different kind of story here for us. Beverly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I was born November 9th, 1940. And the story is my dad, my family were farmers. And my dad got out the old 1937 Chev and took Mom to the hospital in Menominee. And then he had to come back and milk the cows that evening. And with the storm, they were snowed in for 3 days. And we didn't have a phone. So my brother and sister, my big siblings shoveled out the driveway, and they were able to get to town to find out if I was a boy or a girl.
Great story.
Oh, that's a great story, Beverly. Thank you so much. And there probably may have been some other stories just like that.
You're right. With the ice and everything else, people couldn't drive. The wires were down. I know another hunter I talked to who was up on Lake Moriah, Earl Oyster, the late Earl Oyster.
Yeah.
He crawled to a farm and was almost collapsed there, and a farmer came out and found him. But there was no way to call, and he had to stay at the farm overnight because the roads were all icy. You know, it was just such tremendous. The weather, another point, I want to make another point, just how it affected the water. The late Milt Geyer, who was in Green Bay, who was an avid duck hunter, and I talked to Milt. So he was hunting the west shore of Green Bay. And he says what happens here is that with a west wind, it will blow the water out of the bay and almost into Lake Michigan. So they were out duck hunting then in their blind. He said after sitting there a few minutes on Armistice Day, the water disappeared and my decoys were resting in mud. I had to go out and throw them out further. Geyer had to move his decoys further out three different times until they were too far away, and he eventually just picked them up and brought them back in closer to him on the mudflat. He told me, boy, oh boy, how the ducks started coming in. They were knocking each other out of the way to get down. I couldn't judge them in the strong wind, and shooting was difficult. Still, the birds were piling in, almost stacked on top of each other, waiting to get down. It wasn't long before I had my limit of 10 ducks. But he said there was another little island in the bay out in front of him, and the hunters out there were stranded and stayed all night. They tipped their boat over and burned their decoys and stocks of their guns for heat. The next morning, they woke up and realized that they had mud rather than water all around them, and they had and walked in the shore. Can you believe that?
They could have walked ashore.
You're right. You're right.
Oh, my goodness me. Well,
let me mention one other thing
for people who
would like to know more, because there's another, I have other people that I've talked to. Unfortunately, they've all passed away now. But all of these stories are so interesting. But somebody that I know you knew, and the late Harold Hetrick.
Oh.
Harold had been the assistant chief warden at the Department of Natural Resources, was a wonderful person. Used to hunt over on the Mississippi River by Ferryville. He hunted out there. Harold was a wonderful sportsman, a wonderful person.
Yeah.
But anyways, Harold went to Washington, D.C. during one of the sesquicentennials, representing Wisconsin and talking about duck hunting on the river. And that has been filmed, and the Wisconsin State Historical Society has that. So if people would like to hear Harold, he was in school that day. He wasn't out hunting. He was in school. But he knew what happened. He was in around Fountain City and got out of school and came down to the river and helped watch as hunters came in. And Harold tells that story, and you can hear him in his own voice. And if you do a digital search for Harold Hetrick and Armistice Day Storm, you can hear it yourself.
I haven't heard that. I played many a game of sheep's head with Harold. He would come to the Hope Rod and Gun Club and give a talk on regulations. And afterwards, the bunch of us would sit down with Harold and play a few hands of sheep's head. He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
He was.
Well, Tim, we're out of time.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Thurman from Ferryville, we didn't get you on to talk about your story, but it's been a pleasure having you back, Tim, and you'll be with us. I'm sure we've got another outdoor writers meeting coming up on the air.
Would love to.
And we'll do that again. Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Well, tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about a memoir of a UW Eau Claire professor growing up Chinese American in the U.S. and Midwest. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.